Wow, I have been so blown away by the feedback from my students inside the Design Business Accelerator. You guys are giving me life. I am so motivated to create more to help you succeed in your business and create the interior design business of your dreams. With that, I am totally on board for creating more content that helps you get where you need to go faster for a more profitable and successful business. So stay tuned as we're about to launch client presentations that convert. So many of you have asked me for that. I know you want in, and that Trello tutorial and templates is totally a game changer for those of you that really need help on process. Want to know what I'm talking about? Go check it out. It's at designbiztoolkit.com. We're having a 50% special right now. I know, like really huge enrollment special. So run on over to www.designbiztoolkit.com and I'll tell you all about it. All right. Thanks for being here. Let's jump into the next episode of Behind the Drapery.
Ever thought about starting your own business as an interior designer? Join Liz Levin, nationally published design entrepreneur of 20 years, as she interviews experts, colleagues, and creatives to pull back the curtain on the design industry. Whether you're passionate about design, eager to start your design business, or simply curious about what happens behind the scenes, we're here to open the doors for you. Welcome to Behind the Drapery Podcast.
I'm so looking forward to having my good friend, Kia Weatherspoon, on the podcast today. Kia and I met about 9 years ago as founding board members of Room to Rebloom. The mission of Room to Rebloom was to empower low-income women and families in the National Capital Area who have been victims of domestic violence by providing them with design services and other resources needed to create beautiful home environments and rebuild their lives. Design, heal, grow was our motto, and that's how Kia and I got to know and work alongside each other. Interior designers instinctively understand the important relationship between one's personal well-being and their environment. And oftentimes, those who could benefit the most from a soft, welcoming, and comforting environment don't have access to it. And it was during those early days of Room to Rebloom that Kia was also building her own interior design firm, Determined by Design. Kia shares in our conversation today that those early projects with Room to Rebloom helped her shape her purpose and gave her a clear direction for her future in Determined by Design. The design voice of impact and change, Kia Weatherspoon has spent the last 15 years defying every design stereotype, the most damaging that interior design is a luxury reserved for a few. Her voice, advocacy for design equity, and design practice have shifted the narrative, making interior design a standard for all. Kia is challenging the lack of these standards in economically challenged communities. Her presence and leadership have created ripples, prompting housing developers, agencies, and industry partners in economically challenged communities to not just take notice of her work, but to do better. As an advocate and educator in business leadership, equity, and diversity, Kia has been recognized as a hip designer for good by Interior Design Magazine and part of the Washington Business Journal's 40 Under 40 class. Kia is adamant change is possible when difficult conversations happen. She has them every day as a female leader of color, speaker, educator, and mentor who exemplifies what's possible for those who are determined by design. Kia is a force and her energy is contagious. I am grateful for her friendship and her time today, and I'm beyond excited to share her inspiring story with you. So please join me in welcoming the one and only Kia Weatherspoon to this week's episode of Behind the Drapery.
It's so good to see you, Kia.
How are you?
Great. You look beautiful.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm loving your art in the background. I've been following your collecting.
I'm trying to put my Zoom on Do Not Disturb because I feel like someone will ping, call, do a thing.
That happens to me every time I put mine in Do Not Disturb, and somehow the messages still pop through.
Come through. I'm like, I'm closing out my inbox. Hey, girl.
Hey, Kia. It's so good to see you. It's been too long. I'm serious. I can't believe. I mean, so long. I used to see you all the time. And now.
I know. Wait, how long has it been? Probably before the pandemic.
Yes. That's when the world fell apart, when our project fell apart. Everything changed.
Oh my God. But it looks like you're doing good. Are you doing good?
Yeah, I am. Things have been, despite thinking the world was coming to an end, then work-wise, the opposite happened for a lot of residential. Yeah, residential design sort of took off in a major way around here with folks still working from home, I guess not traveling and investing in their spaces. So it's been unusually busy the last few years work-wise.
Still? But do you feel like it's like kind of shifting back down or no? It's good.
You know, I felt like the second year, I feel like it was boom, boom, boom. And then I want to say, well, last year was really busy the year before. So that was kind of in the middle. Was that 2022?
Yeah.
All blurring together. I thought, whoa, it took a little bit of a dip. And I heard that from colleagues too, because we were all just running. And then I think people took a breather. But yeah, no, it's still... it's back. It's busy. And then the vendors now are finally getting things to us on a more timely pre-pandemic manner. You know,
nice.
Crazy. But how about you? How was your pandemic?
you know, my pandemic wasn't bad. Like from a business perspective, it was good. Like we grew from like 2.5 to 14 people from 2021 until now.
Are you serious? You got to tell me everything. We haven't caught up in so long.
I know.
I'm so excited. The growth is amazing. And then you physically moved, right? You're in Atlanta now, right?
I moved to Atlanta. I was dual state. And then I was like, that's not cute. And then I moved back. So now I'm officially back in DC. Not a lot of people do unless they like see me in the DC streets and they like, what you doing here?
I saw you.
Hustle.
Hustle. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I came back to DC in June of officially June of last year.
Really? My goodness. I've had my head in the sand all this time. I thought you were down there. And
no one really knows. I was in like a very like deep, deep depression for a very long time. Coming back from teaching and the whole thing. Because I felt like I had failed.
I know you love teaching and your students were doing so well. So
I think what happened is, you know, when you do a panel and then it's all the pre-conversation that was like, that should have been on a panel.
Yes. That's what we're doing.
So I think a big part of it was I knew I wanted to do this thing that was outside of my business. No, I think it was in alignment with my business, but it was in alignment with who I was. Like inherently, I love teaching. Inherently, I love sharing with others and teaching and letting them learn from my mistakes and my hardship. But doing it in someone else's construct of a high academic institution, it was so bad. It was so bad. Yeah, it was.
Too limiting?
I think it was limiting. I think I knew that wasn't how I flourished. I built my business in a way that felt like a safe space for me to operate and move as a Black woman and the work I was going to do. And I go in someone else's construct and it didn't feel like that. But I was so like, hell-bent, like, I can do this. I can do it. I can do it. And my students loved me and I loved them, but I was so empty. So for the better part of 18 months, I was just like deeply suicidal and deeply depressed.
Yeah. Oh mm-hmm. my gosh, my heart. I didn't realize you were going mm-hmm. through all of that.
So it's so funny when people just passed recently, like I don't think I've really been posting on social media for like the past 18 months because I was in such a bad headspace in a way. So when I came back to DC, I also felt like I failed. Here I am again, back in DC, same faces, same people. And I had to work through that. I had to work through that deeply, 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 deeply.
Well, I did notice your absence because I do enjoy following all the things that you're doing and sharing.
All of my asinine dance moves?
No, I love those. That's part of the charm. People need to tune in for the dance moves. Well, for those that you and I are in our intimate conversation, let me take us back to the beginning so we can share with folks. You have such a unique career path, you know, and where you've evolved from your dancing days to so much in between to now.
Wait, so.
We got to go way back. You got to talk.
Okay. And then I'm going to sit down like a normal person, but I needed to my Luke's coffee mug for all my Gilmore Girl fans.
I always started watching that again in the pandemic too, because my girl.
Isn't it delightful? I love the Gilmore Girls.
I know.
So delightful.
It is so good. And also, I want to say no failure, returning to your roots, regrouping. But before you regrouped, you did a lot to start. Let's roll back. Early days.
Early days.
You started out as a young Kia. Wildly talented and creative.
So wildly talkative, wildly chatty, wildly like into people. But no, seriously, my younger self, I think I wanted to be a ballet dancer. I knew I wanted to be a ballet dancer. I wanted to dance in Alvin Ailey. I danced when I was a little girl. Went to college and I was a C student. And I always like to preface that. Don't ask me why. But I got into college. I don't know. Because when you think about the success I have now.
Yes.
You assume like, oh, she must have been a great student and this and that. And it was not that. I did not get financial aid and I decided, okay, I'm going to join the military to get money for school.
Amazing.
Very brilliant plan at the time. And yeah. I was like, I'm going to join the Air Force and I'm going to get stationed on the East Coast. And then I'll take dance classes at night and
a renaissance woman on all fronts.
Yeah. Yes. It's like, I'm all is going to be right with the world. I got stationed in Wichita, Kansas.
Wait a minute.
Yes. Wichita, Kansas. And that was in, I would say, July of 2001. But three months later, September 11th happened.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And I was on my first of 5 deployments to the Middle East. And I remember my first one is at Al Udeid Air Base in Doha, Qatar. And I was in a tent with about 14 other women. I needed some privacy. I needed to cry. I didn't have it. So I took some sheets. I hung it from the top of my tent. And I made 3 sheet walls. And that was the first space I ever created. And I bawled like a baby for 15 minutes.
Oh.
And it was something about how that space like healed me and brought me comfort and solace. And I would do that on 4 different deployments. And when I got out of active duty military, I was like, I want to do this thing where I create spaces for people. And that was interior design.
That's the most unique way of finding interior design, the power of your environment ever. You've shared that story with me personally, but I love that the way you've explained it. It's so powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so funny. That's the first time someone was like, ooh, the power of environment, because that's what it really was about. And a lot of times people say, oh, that's so cool. And I'm like, but is it though? Is it? And I think it aligns with the work deeply with the work I do now.
For sure.
It is not cool that I had to go to war to realize the power of my environment.
No, because you enlisted as a way to get to your next, you know, education.
Yeah. Yeah.
So signing up for 9/11 deployment was not really.
Was not on the bingo card?
No, that wasn't on the list of options when you were signing up as a ballet dancer. I mean, I can't even imagine. I mean, the intensity and the shock and the experience of it all.
Absolutely. But I will say this, joining the military was one of those things I would do it the exact same way again and again. I have some of the best people, lessons on leadership, life. Yeah, I would do it again over and over again the exact same way. And I retired in 2022.
I remember when you were doing some active duty when we were chatting early 2020, and you're like, here I go downtown with my gear. And I'm serious.
even that, like, I think that was when I knew I needed to get out of the military. But I did 21 years of active duty guard and reserve.
So impressive.
Yeah, it was. I didn't love every minute of it, but it's one of those things that I deeply learned so much from.
You grew a lot from that experience.
Yeah, I did. It was invaluable, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine. It wasn't what you planned, and you got a totally different experience. And it's the understatement of the year. What can I say? I'm sitting here, I'm really like trying to imagine being in your position at that time. And then you're such a strong person anyway, and resilient and creative. And so, I mean, hearing it after the fact, like, of course Kia did that and sailed through it. I mean, like, but you.
Absolutely. I made it through it. And there were so many highs and lows, but I will say in the whole 2020-21 thing, like, being activated with the guard when everything was going on, that was a very clear moment that it was time for me to move on, because that was the first time I didn't feel proud to have on that uniform. And I felt really conflicted about being like a Black woman in a uniform during a racial uprising and protesting happening. And it was so many things. But what was instilled in me in that moment was, it was myself and another woman from the shop I worked in. she and I were the only two people who kind of got not stuck, but that in the shuffle got required to go out in the streets. And I could have kind of finagled my way out of it, but the military has instilled in me, you are always supposed to be a good wingman. She was my wingman in that moment and I couldn't leave her hanging. And it resulted in us both just being out during the ride. And it was just, ugh. And I was so conflicted, but that's when I knew it was time for me to retire. But still, like, I wouldn't change a thing.
Well, at that point, your business was really flourishing too. So from that moment of hanging the three sheets to create a personal space, how did you go from coming home to, tell me about the design? How did you get into it?
Okay. I decided I was going to get my degree in interior design. Boom. Did that. Check. Went to work for one interior design firm. I did an internship and then I worked for a firm in Great Falls, Virginia, doing multifamily design. I worked there for maybe like 16 months. And immediately I was burnt out. I was tired. I was underpaid. You know, I had just had got my degree. So I was all bright eyed and bushy tailed. And I was like designing concepts and this and that. And I was like, oh my God, but the workplace and the culture sucked. And I was like, is it me? Is it the profession? Or is it this company?
What kind of projects were you working on?
Right? Multifamily. Oh yeah. Large multifamily apartment buildings. And market rate apartment buildings, luxury apartment buildings. And I didn't really know that was a thing to focus on multifamily, common areas, corridors. So it was a great kind of niche market that I was like, didn't learn about it in school. And I remember I had pulled an all-nighter and went to present to the client. And my boss at the time didn't say, thank you, take a comp day, nothing. It was just like, keep going. I was like, this isn't the life. This is not what I signed up for. And then one day we got a new project and my boss was like, Kia, you just don't seem excited. And I was like, I'm not. And then I gave my 2 weeks notice. And
good
then
for
I was
you.
Like, very, very fair. Right.
Right.
And then I was like, I'm going to start my own business.
Just right then, like out of the first job. I kind of knew. I love it. I was like, I know how that feels. Yes. Continue. Just do it.
Yeah. And it was so funny because I knew a couple of things. I was like, all right, is this place? I was like, well, I want to go work somewhere where they have leadership that looks like me. In 2012, that was not happening. And I was like, I want to go somewhere and work where they put their people first. I don't think that still happens in a lot of firms, but anyway. And then I'm going to start my business. And it was, I started the business. I knew I wanted to focus on multifamily design. This is kind of where you and I overlap.
I love our story. I remember those early days.
Oh, girl. So, okay. So, friends, let's go back. So I'm starting a business. I don't have 6 months of my salary saved up. I don't have a business plan. All the things they tell you to do to start a business.
Right.
No one advised you not to do those things. But anyway.
But you're here today. So a shining example of how taking a little risk can work.
Absolutely. So I get an email blast about a nonprofit organization that's about to start. It was like an all call for designers. Was it just for designers, was it?
I think it was. It was, well, I was addressed as a designer and said, hey, we're starting this nonprofit. It's a way to give back in your industry. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, why not do that? So I think it was designers. So yeah,
It was designers. And then a bunch of us come and it's this organization called Room to Rebloom. And it was about creating healing home environments for domestic violence survivors. So all these people are in the room and we're talking about it. It's a brainchild happening. And Liz and I are like the last two people to leave.
Yes.
After this,
this
meeting. And we're just standing in the parking garage waiting for our cars. Like, what did you think? And we just like chit-chatted.
And we connected immediately. I was like, I like this person, Kia. She's great. And I felt like it was such an odd meeting. I think at the end of that meeting too, we're not mentioning that the person that was hosting it was like, so who wants, she explains the concept. And then she's like, so I'm not going to stay. I'm not going to see it through, but who wants to do it? Basically, we're like, what?
We're like, wait, what?
Organization?
I mean, I thought it was a wonderful idea and she was being candid, so I'm not trying to throw her into the
bus. No, it's I forgot that part.
Yeah, because I thought, well, this sounds really interesting to me and I want to give back. And you're right, there's so much waste in the industry that could be repurposed in a positive way. And again, back to, so Room to Rebloom created these healing home environments.
Yes.
And that was such a big, you know, back to your hanging your three sheets while you were employed, could really relate to, when you're healing and you're coming out of these domestic violence, horrible situations.
Absolutely.
Not having a personal space, not having your own space for a lot of these women. They didn't, you know, they had gone from husbands to boyfriends. Yes.
Yes. So, but what I don't think, you know, is that was a very clear pivotal moment for me of what I knew my company was going to focus on. Because when we first went in there, I remember the women being like, hey, we don't need this. This isn't relevant to our lives. Like, calm down. I was like overly excited. I remember for me, it was about immersing them in the design process and doing it with them, not for them. That was a very clear distinctive for me.
Yeah, it was. I remember. Yeah.
And when they were talking, when it went from we don't need this to like, wow, I thought this was stuff I could only see on TV. Is this something I could do one day? And I think we were all there. And when that woman said to us, like, when I walked into this room, I realized change was possible. That was my moment of really signifying the people who need access to well-designed spaces the most, they don't know they don't have it. They don't know they need it. And they don't have an advocate. I built my entire practice around being that advocate and focusing on affordable, low income, supportive and transitional housing, all from doing a nonprofit project at the start of my business.
So incredible. It was a real pivotal point for you then. And the experience, and you took on the very first project. We made Room to Rebloom, made partnerships with nonprofits that were already established and knew their clients, or, you know, the women they were serving, I should say.
Yeah.
Not clients, the women they were serving. And so we were able to partner with people that were really doing the work and add a layer of a healing home environment and resources that didn't exist. And I remember you having that. You took on the first project. You volunteered to do that big
communal. And my business wasn't even like 3 years old.
I don't think I realized how new you were, because you didn't come across as being that startup-y. Then you seemed very established to me. You had a clear point of view and you had a lot of energy. And you know, and I think because you had also your degree, I didn't go to school for it. I was more self-taught in residential. So your type of experience, we were comparing notes. I was like, oh, she knows what she's doing. Commercial degree, all of this. But I remember that first it was a multifamily space
and you
yes, that was and all the different elements they wanted to incorporate in sort of a common area, family space.
Yeah. The kids room,
the yoga. It was, I saw the light bulb going off. Like, this is my purpose. This is how, in a way, I don't put words in your mouth, but
No. But it was a very like clear focus. And I think a big part of it was, well, if this is what this building looks like for these women, there are more buildings like that around the world, the district. So it was very clear to me from that project of, this is where my talents need to go. This is where my talent, this is where my purpose lies. And while I kind of jokingly said like, oh, I didn't have a business plan, blah, 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 I think sometimes when you're so busy trying to plan the thing, what you need or what is purpose driven could have passed you by. Because my business plan would have said, try to get more luxury apartment building projects, try to get more market rate apartment. That was what my business plan would have told me. But I was open and I allowed these other opportunities to come. And it guided me towards a more purpose-driven path and an untapped market from a business perspective.
Yeah. Really untapped. And the fact that you're open to even going to this meeting, I mean, and meeting this group and staying on, I mean, it was kind of a random group. And then the real interested parties stuck around and did something interesting.
We did the work. We did the work.
You were 3 years into, that's determined by design. Was it determined by design then? Or it was called, is that how
it was? It was always determined by design.
I couldn't remember the name change.
No, I always knew it was going to be determined by design. Always. Great. I never wanted my name on the door.
That's smart, actually. I think, you know, I have my name on the door and it's like, it's just you and you don't know the team behind you. So.
And you hit the nail on the head. I think the firm that I worked at, I saw what happened when like the leader would come and it was what she wanted, and it was her aesthetic. There was a whole team behind it. And I think maybe a little like foreshadowing, like I want to retire like to somebody's beach. And I want this thing that I've built to live separately and apart from me.
And scale. You can scale.
And scale. Yeah. Scale. Scale, not big, but deep and wide. I don't think I ever want to be a big, huge firm, but for me, it's about impact. Impact is the biggest size that I focus on, not the size of my team or my company. Because I was doing huge projects and it was just me and a 1099 for the first probably 8 years.
No one knew that it was just you two, you mean? You
had no one knew.
Presence. Describe some of those early projects where no one knew it was you and a 1099 running these major projects. What kind of projects were you doing?
So my first project was a 25-unit, five-story apartment buildings with a development partner named Dante's Partners. They're here in the D.C. area. Bua Benitier and Corey Powell, it was just the two of them. And that was our first project. And the most strategic thing that I did is I didn't look for the biggest client. I looked for the partners that we could grow with. Then we immediately did, and I will just like to foot stomp. I had to take $10,000 off my first fee, $10,000. But I saw the vision of they were a long-term partner. So it really wasn't about the money.
When you say long-term, you saw them just growing their business?
I saw them growing. I think a big part of what we do is need to be able to assess, is this a right now relationship or partner, or is this a long-term partner? And in that moment, I knew I needed partners that I could grow with.
Sure, yeah.
And my business could grow with. So then we immediately did a transitional housing project for women with mental health challenges called Phyllis Wheatley YWCA. That was a completely historic renovation. Then the next project ended up being 125 units in Southeast DC with WC Smith called Archer Park. So really just became building after building that would go from 25 units to then doing two buildings, Kenilworth Courts with the DC Housing Authority. That's a total of 250 units across two buildings. And it was just me and someone who was doing my contract documentation.
Holy smokes. That is so much work to take on as a solo operator with a sidekick, for lack of a better word, operations manager, assistant. No.
And then we had projects in Chicago, because when public housing redevelopments happen, they're typically like a multi-building project or multi-building development. So we started working with this developer called the Community Builders. They had two buildings in Chicago that I worked on. It was a lot of large scale, small to mid-sized, large scale multifamily projects that I was literally just working my way through and designing. I was hungry, Liz. I was so determined.
Determined? By design? Yes. By design.
Yes.
That's the perfect name.
Yeah.
But I mean, you've got to be hungry in the beginning. I mean, you know, part of this podcast is to coach up and coming designers and give access to these behind the scenes conversations because, well, you know, people look at all of your accomplishments and where you are, and, you know, it's hard to imagine where we all start out, where you started out, and all the hunger and work and just straight grit and sweat that you put into this to get it off the ground. It looks, you know, the polished, glossy, finished product. You're never finished, right? We're always a work in progress, but that glossy product now,
It's so funny you say that, because I remember, and my ego doesn't allow me to believe that everybody knows who I am, right? But I remember the kind of crux of, I got, like 2019 into 2021, I was like a media and press darling. I won all the awards. I did all the things.
Oh, the photo shoots, all the gorgeous pictures. I was like, what is she doing now?
But designer, what was it? Hip Designer for Good, Interior Design Magazine. I was Luna Textile Visionary. I was just getting so much press and so many things. And I remember someone just, they casually goes like, oh, well, you know, they're just really looking for a lot of Black designers right now. And I was like, absolutely not. I had been at this for seven, my head was down and I was doing the work for the past 7 years. my bell curve just start happened at the height of a racial reckoning. That had nothing to do. And I was kind of offended by it because, like you just said, no, I was doing the work, been doing the work.
For years. I mean, for years, I feel like you had that opportunity, that timing just happened to come together. Yeah. But people that knew you and knew the work you were doing for
absolutely.
Years, it was just like a perfect, not a perfect storm, because it was a positive thing, but you know what I mean?
You don't get designer of the year for the diversity, equity, inclusion bubble, like boom happening.
No,
it was years of work, relationship building. You don't get, like, I got Design for Humanity awardee from the ASID because of years of focusing on creating equitable design outcomes in affordable and low income housing. It was years of doing that work.
Yeah, years, literally years. And
started, years.
And having that aha moment years ago and then applying that. And also having that first job experience where you said, I wasn't in the company that I wanted. I didn't feel represented. I didn't feel the people were put first. All of that led to your next moment, led to the, you know, volunteer work that you were
absolutely
doing. All of that. Yeah. And how do you explain to people why these well-designed spaces should be the standard for all and not luxury for a few? I know that's such an important, I mean, we're talking about how you got there, but how did you walk into those rooms? Did it suddenly shift? Like when you had these developer partners, did you suddenly say, not suddenly, but come in with a more of a message or purpose-driven
design? Oh, absolutely, girl.
Okay.
I came in there on my soapbox. I was like, no, I wasn't like, excuse me, sir, because I would never say that. But I was more so like, hey, do you know the affordable housing that you're creating, the transitional housing? It's ugly. I mean, I dressed it up, obviously. And I was like, it's sterile. It's institutional. There's no color. There's no softness. There's no texture. You can do better and you should do better. Because people deserve to be in beauty and softness and decoration and adornment. And they were like, sweet, sweet girl, the money piece, that's too expensive. They will tear it up. And there was this inherent bias that just kept coming out and coming out and coming out. And this is why I say partner a lot and not client. Because if I only saw them as transactional, I would not have corrected their bias and said, actually, creating and having people traverse and live in beautiful, soft spaces, that is a standard of how everybody should live. It's a right. And you are doing less than that. And if money is the problem or the barrier, we can design in a way that is within your budget. But it's this preconceived notion that if I put this Calcutta looking tile in front of you, that's expensive. When it's like, my friend, it's really a knockoff. That's $2.25 a square foot just because. So and that's the misconception that anything that looks good is expensive. And I had to really understand when a large real estate development project happens, their budget, their GMP is critical. So if I can get the design outcome I want and meet their budget, I'm golden. So if the only barrier then becomes you don't want it nice because you don't think these poor people deserve nice things. And you have to be purpose driven to challenge someone to say, hey, you know, your bias is showing.
Yeah. Yeah. How did they react to this? Were they inspired? Were they? I totally agree with you. I mean, obviously.
I think it was a combination of both. I think once I made them a believer and once they saw my value add as a business owner, they were like, okay. Other times it was like, well, let's see what happens in 6 months and will they tear it up? I think it's once they get it, that it is possible, then those partners are golden. But sometimes it's not just the real estate developer. It's the housing authority. It's the general contractor. It's the architect that we work with. So there's a lot of convincing people of, hey, do better. And this is where the empathy and equity piece come in. I often would do this exercise where I would say, well, is this a space you would want for your kids? Or your loved one? And they'd be like, exactly. Then why is it good enough for this person's loved one? So it's a lot of challenging and educating.
I wholeheartedly believe in what you're challenging these developers with. And I'm sitting here questioning if it's such a budget driven, large scale process, and you're able to deliver a beautiful design within their budget, what's the hang up? What's the stop? I mean, I know you're saying bias. They say it looks too nice. I mean, it sort of like blows my mind that it wouldn't be like, thanks, Kia. Thanks for bringing this.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I don't think people, and this is where I am in service to people in communities, not a developer, not a funding agency or a source. And I think that deeply driven purpose of making sure people are surrounded by beauty and softness very, very early on. Because note, I didn't talk about my childhood home. Like, I didn't talk about the home I grew up, or I didn't talk about any of that creating this visceral reaction of possibility for me. Another kind of like key point I left out of my origin story was kind of like, my brother was incarcerated for 15 years. And I viscerally remember the first time I walked into a prison, but I can never, ever tell you about anything about the home I grew up in. And I think my touch point is, what happens if at a younger age, people are traversing and moving and living through beauty and softness? What possibilities are afforded to them about the power of space and the power of environment?
The way they feel about themselves, families and the children and the mothers we were serving in our work together. That was the most exciting and transformative. Yeah. Was that feeling of self-worth that was elevated.
Possibility. Absolutely.
Possibility. And you think, how can an environment do that? But when you were in such a desperate environment and are given that softness and beauty.
Yes. Yes.
As a gift, you know, to them as
the way of being. And I think that's always been my guidepost, is like, no one should ever have to experience that ever. And I think there's always often this disconnect when, if our development partner or the architect is white, and it's kind of like, I get it, because you can't see yourself or your family members in these community. I can. I grew up there. I have team members who grew up in those spaces. And it's that's where the empathy comes into play of like, hey, I need you to see that what you've done is not good enough and we can do better. And you should. And we as a business, that's been our charge. And I think eight years ago now, before it was trendy and cute, like, we trademarked design equity. So we are the only interior design firm in the nation that provides design equity services.
That's so incredible. You need to define that for our audience who may not know, just in case someone.
No, absolutely. So design equity is about using a historical point of reference and origin and context to develop design stories, concepts, intentions, prayer, color story, materiality, design moves based on the narrative of a city, of a place, of a neighborhood. It is not thematic. It is not style based. It's not about mid-century, modern, traditional, all those things are deeply rooted in ego, but it is about taking the historical narratives and turning those into design moments, and what we call story keeping of the people and the places and the moments that have happened. That is what design equity is about, elevating the standard of design through story.
That's so powerful for multifamily, larger spaces. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. in residential design, we'll go in and say, you want to tell your family story, you want to, yes. You know, reflect you in your home. That's sort of a given with residential, but with these larger scale mm-hmm. multifamily projects, especially in the inner cities and where you're describing that this design doesn't exist. It's been given this sterile.
Kind absolutely. Of this poverty aesthetic.
Yeah. It's depressing. I mean, how do you expect people to feel motivated, inspired, and good when they're living in an institutionalized looking space?
Absolutely. Could you imagine it? And I talk about, you know, the pandemic, I was speaking to some students a couple of weeks ago, and I was telling them, like, you all have to think about the work that you do as interior designers that could possibly affect 4 to 6 generations of family members. Whether you think about it from a perspective of like, I did an apartment building, an office building, a hotel, someone's home, right? The work we do now, it has generational effects. And do we think about it that way? That gives it some depth that I think sometimes goes, that could be missed.
Absolutely. I don't think if you're designing a space that it's sort of, you don't see the individual in that space. I think that's at the heart of it. You're seeing it as this big public, for lack of a better word, space, right? There's going to be more generations, groups of people. Maybe they're faceless to you because you don't know them individually. And it's, you know, it's not personalized. It's not
personal
story and exactly that. No, I think that's really interesting to put it that way.
But if you think about the pandemic and the people who lived in inhumane public housing that was built generations ago, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So the work I'm doing now, I have to think about it from the perspective of when the next global thing happens and we're entrapped in our homes. What were the things that bought those who had access to design or means? What were the things that bought them comfort? And it was softness. It was beauty. It was decoration. It was natural light. You know, it wasn't like, oh, it was Pantone's color of the year. That stuff is frivolous. No shade, Pantone. But
yes.
No, so I think the impact is what happens beyond right now. And that's what we do. At Determined by Design, my team, we create generational impact through design.
And have that ripple effect for generations, right?
Yeah. Ooh, that just gave me chills. It wasn't the first time I said it that way, but that's what we do.
I want to hear some story of these developers that maybe didn't appreciate it from the get-go, who came back to you and maybe said, you were so right, Kia. Look at this space. Look at this reaction to the space.
You know what? So all of our long-term partners, they have drunk the Kool-Aid and they're here for it and they love it. And it was so funny. I was just talking with a construction manager. We just finished a project here in the district. It's called Station UNO. It's beautiful. And I go, you guys are going to get me in trouble. And she was like, why? And I was like, because everyone wants to say, like, how come our projects don't look like that? And I'm like, well, they can. You just have to allow us to do what we do. And so this is a beautiful project. It has this beautiful cascading quilt drapery in the double height community space.
Wow.
It has these large kind of 18 by 36 floor tile. It's just so, it's a little decadent, but it's possibility. And when other developers see that work, they go, okay, we could do this. But you have to feel like the people that this space is, that they're worthy of it.
I'm going to stop us right there as we pick up part two next week in our conversation on Behind the Drapery. Thanks for being here with us and see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Behind the Drapery, where we pull back the curtain on the interior design industry through stories, insights, and creative processes that shape the spaces we create. Make sure you subscribe to get the latest episodes from your favorite podcast platform. And visit our website at lizlevininteriors.com for more information.